Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIES Energy podcast series. My name's James Henderson, and I am Director of the Gas Programme here at OIES. And today I'm here with Alex Barnes, who's a Visiting Research Fellow, and Katya Yefimova, who's a Senior Research Fellow, to discuss their latest energy insight called EU Hydrogen Vision, Regulatory Opportunities and Challenges. Alex, Katya, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Hello. Good to be here as well.
Right, Alex, I'm going to turn to you first, if I may. We had a recent paper by Martin Lambert, who's also been writing about hydrogen, which outlined the key aspects of the hydrogen strategy and concluded that it covers all possibilities for hydrogen in the energy transition, as he put it. I mean, your paper obviously looks at a much broader array of documents and pulls together some of the regulatory issues. And I think it's interesting perhaps to start with the fact that, you know, we have a sector integration strategy from the EU and an industrial strategy which pull in hydrogen. That's quite interesting in its own right, isn't it?
Yes, the integration strategy is driven very much by the whole decarbonisation agenda, and it's recognising that in order to decarbonise, that means relying a lot more on renewable energy, and then this raises certain issues for how we manage our energy systems overall. And as part of that, you've got the ideas such as sector coupling, this sort of link between renewable electricity and gaseous fuels. And you've got this recognition that we cannot just rely on electrification to decarbonize. There are certain sectors which aren't suitable, heavy industry or heavy transport, and this is where hydrogen comes in. So it's important that this system integration strategy recognizes that there's a role for hydrogen, and it's not just going to be all electricity. And that's quite a big step forward. And then the industrial strategy, well, obviously, commissions always have an industrial strategy. But what's interesting there is they specifically pick out support for what they call clean steel using hydrogen, and also things like strengthening support for renewable energy industries and a carbon border adjustment tax, all of which potentially support hydrogen. So the hydrogen strategy is the link and the more detailed aspect, but the important message is that hydrogen is now definitely on the agenda as part of Europe's energy future.
Great. So essentially good news for gas in a sense. Katya then, I mean, Alex has mentioned the hydrogen strategy itself is the kind of link between this. Can you pick out a few of the highlights of the hydrogen strategy for us, the most important elements?
A hydrogen strategy is obviously a main element which sets up this hydrogen vision that the Commission has. It clearly recognises that renewable hydrogen is its priority. It does make it clear its priority as the end game. At the same time, strategy acknowledges that other forms of low carbon hydrogen will play a role in short and medium term, and that is good news for gas. However, the strategy is a lot more detailed and forthcoming on renewable hydrogen and not so much on low carbon hydrogen, so that could be built up on and improved. And in our comment, we develop further the comment written by Martin Lambert earlier, focusing now on regulatory opportunities and challenges that the EU is facing in making this vision a reality. And we believe that an important thing is that the EU is trying to look at the whole value chain. It looks at production of hydrogen, demand of hydrogen, and infrastructure, and trying to look at the whole picture together, and providing certain regulatory and financial mechanisms for realization of this vision going forward.
Okay, great. And in terms of the kind of ambitions and the targets, Alex, maybe I can come back to you. Some quite aggressive ambitions are laid out in the hydrogen strategy. Could you just give a bit of detail around those?
Yeah, sure. They've kind of set out sort of three phases, and they're very quick. By 2024, if memory serves, they want sort of 10 gigawatts of renewable hydrogen. So that's hydrogen based on electricity, renewable electricity through electrolyzers. And then they want 40 gigawatts of that by 2030, and then up to 500 by 2050. And there's a lot of they expect large amounts of investment. So between sort of now and 2050, they expect investment of between 180 and 470 billion euros in renewable hydrogen. But as Katia mentioned, there's also a clear role for low carbon hydrogen. This is hydrogen from natural gas where the carbon is captured and stored, or it's solid carbon from pyrolysis. But it's interesting, and this is something that we make in our paper, that this is a bit of the underdog because they expect less investment in that. But at the same time, they recognise that the costs of renewable hydrogen are a lot higher. So this raises questions as to, you know, how much renewable hydrogen is going to come forth within the time frame, and how much low carbon hydrogen there will be, and whether there will be enough hydrogen to meet the objectives overall.
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, I guess we'll come back to the realism, and if you like, and whether these things are achievable later on once we've discussed how they're going to be supported. Katia, before we go there, I know that there's some terminology which is outlined in the strategy. I think we should probably just get into that because we're stopping using colours now, no more blue and green, and now we're talking about other forms of hydrogen. So could you just run us quickly through what the terminology is?
Yes, exactly. That's a very strong point of the hydrogen strategy, that it actually finally outlined quite clear terminology and labels for different types of hydrogen, allowing all us to move away from this color coding scheme, which has been frankly quite confusing. The main categories which are set by the strategy and which we deal with in our insight is renewable hydrogen, and that is hydrogen produced from renewable electricity via electrolysis or via conversion of biogas or biomass. And low carbon hydrogen, which includes, importantly, fossil-based hydrogen from methane, for example, with carbon capture. And it also includes electricity-based hydrogen with, quote-unquote, significantly reduced emissions. So these are two main categories, and then we refer to them in our comment as renewable hydrogen, as Alex said, very big bold vision for it in the strategy, and also a more supportive and shorter term role for low carbon methane based carbon capture hydrogen.
Alex, do you want to add anything on the terminology side?
Yeah, I think as Katia said, it's great that we're moving away from all these confusing colours. And what's really important is by focusing on the carbon content, they do help ensure that future framework should be based on carbon footprint and therefore should be technology neutral. However, there is a tension here because at the same time they say that that renewable hydrogen is the priority. And the question is that ultimately, of course, renewable hydrogen is zero carbon footprint. But the issue that we have is how quickly we can decarbonize and how quickly we can ramp up. So the terminology helps by focusing on carbon footprint rather than production method. But then at the same time, you have this tension within the paper that they actually really favour renewable, but admit that they need low carbon hydrogen in the meantime as well.
And that favouritism, if you like, is also reflected, I think, in the levels of support that are being offered to the various forms of hydrogen. Alex, can I just keep with you for a second? And can you talk us a little bit through the kind of the different levels of financial support and incentives that are being offered to the different forms of hydrogen and how important that contrast is?
Sure. Well, in terms of, I mentioned earlier that the EU in the paper expects investment of between 180 and 470 billion euros for renewable hydrogen by 2050. But they only expect between 3 and 18 billion euros of investment for low carbon hydrogen over that period. And that's quite a big gap, especially when you consider that at the moment the cost of renewable hydrogen is several times that of both low carbon hydrogen and just normal natural gas. So there's a clear bias there. Also, some of the mechanisms are only going to be open to renewable hydrogen, such as direct support schemes, though other things such as carbon contracts for difference, etc., will be available to both types of hydrogen production.
And Katia, let me turn to you. So how are these decisions about financing going to get made? You mentioned the European Clean Hydrogen Alliance in the insight. How are choices going to be made between the various projects that are going to get financing support?
Yeah, that is a good question. The strategy does state explicitly that the European Clean Hydrogen Alliance, which was established as part of the industrial strategy, will play a crucial role in facilitating and implementing the actions of the strategy and in supporting investments to scale up production and demand for renewable and low carbon hydrogen. The Commission states that this alliance will identify projects that are commercially viable, and it will facilitate coordinated investments along the carbon, the hydrogen value chain. What's interesting, however, is the strategy doesn't really specify the criteria for selecting projects, but it does say that the Commission will follow up on the recommendations that will be made by the Strategic Forum for Important Projects of Common European Interest, so-called IPCE, which will contribute to the uptake of those projects through Hydrogen Alliance and move the projects further. But so far is a little bit of uncertainty. In fact, it's significant uncertainty as to how the projects will be selected, because there is no clear selection criteria identified. But I think it's quite clear that priority, again, is for renewable hydrogen. So this kind of theme of favoritism between renewable and low carbon is also present here. But there are also other financing facilities envisaged, such as the InvestEU program, European Regional Development Fund, Cohesion Fund, Just Transition Mechanism, Connecting Europe Facility for Transport, all sorts of things.
Okay, good. Thanks. So, Alex, maybe I can just pick up that again with you, this kind of element of the favouritism. I mean, there are some incentives being offered, aren't there, which, as you've mentioned, are relevant to the low-carbon hydrogen. Can you talk a little bit about the contracts for difference and also about the ETS and how it might be revised and how important that could be?
Sure. Well, the Carbon Contracts for Difference essentially recognises that you need a much higher carbon price to make either low carbon hydrogen or renewable hydrogen competitive. So the idea is essentially that a project will have a carbon strike price with some form of state-backed entity. It's not clear from the paper. And that will be at a given carbon price. And so long as that given carbon price is higher than the market carbon price, then the state-backed entity will pay the project the money. So it and there'll be less of a subsidy if carbon prices rise. The thing is, there's not a lot of detail on this, although it is an innovative idea, and I think it is helpful. The issue, just to give you some kind of scale, is that current hydrogen production in the EU emits between 70 and 100 million tons of CO2 a year. And to use, based on the figures in the paper, that could lead to subsidy compared to the current carbon price of about 6.5 billion euros per year, which is quite a lot. The other problem is that you need to revise the ETS to allow for the fact that at the moment it doesn't cover all sectors of the economy. It only covers 45% of emissions. And within that, quite a lot of industries get free allowances because they compete with overseas companies, you know, imports from abroad. And there's this issue of carbon leakage. So all of this needs to be sorted out if you're to have a working kind of ETS carbon price overall, and also something that works that enables hydrogen, because at the moment the cost gap is just too much. So it's good news that, you know, there's been thought as to mechanisms how to do it. I think the challenge is writing all those rules, whether for whatever support mechanism to get the hydrogen projects off the ground.
And there's also some mention of a carbon border tax. Is that right? And that would presumably favour all forms of hydrogen in the European Union.
Yes, the carbon border tax is specifically mentioned in the industrial strategy as well. And it's because of this idea that they want to retain steel production, for example, in Europe. But if they impose too high costs on it, obviously production could emigrate to places where there aren't the same carbon costs. However, the carbon border adjustment tax, that's a whole topic, a whole podcast in its own right, I suspect. The issue there is it compatible with WTO trade rules and so forth? But the idea is that you can't, your indigenous industry doesn't suffer as a result of imports from elsewhere where carbon prices are lower or CO2 emissions aren't regulated.
Okay. Katja, you want to chip in on that?
Just a quick point to add, if I may, on regulatory carbon contracts for difference. So despite the clear preference of the strategy for renewable hydrogen, that's potentially a very interesting supportive instrument, particularly for low carbon hydrogen, because at present it is significantly less expensive than renewable hydrogen, and therefore for some time could be the main beneficiary of this scheme.
Okay, no, that's a very good point. So, I mean, it's kind of, again, relatively good news for blue hydrogen, or sorry, I can't say blue hydrogen, can I? Low carbon hydrogen in the short term. Okay, I mean, I think the other regulatory area that's really important and that actually many people don't touch on is on infrastructure. And I know the hydrogen strategy does get into discussions about infrastructure in various stages out to 2050. Katja, maybe I could turn to you and just ask you to outline how the hydrogen strategy sees the development of hydrogen infrastructure over the next 20 to 30 years.
Yes, the strategy essentially connects the issues of supply and demand, hydrogen and infrastructure, and those two obviously are mutually dependent. The strategy links different stages of infrastructure development to the different phases of hydrogen production. And those are the three phases. The next 5 years up to 2025, then 2025 to 2030, and the stage beyond 2030. And those are mostly linked to development of renewable hydrogen, with low hydrogen basically developing as it develops, but it's not the main focus. The strategy unfortunately lacks a clear vision of how low carbon hydrogen will make this journey, but nonetheless it envisages certain regulatory instruments of support during each stage, and I'll talk briefly about each of those. So the first stage up to 2025, the infrastructure needs according to the strategy will remain relatively limited, because demand will be met initially by production close to or on the site in industrial clusters through existing connections. Whereas replacement of fossil fuel hydrogen with low carbon hydrogen by adding carbon capture and storage would require construction of CO2 transportation pipelines and CO2 storage. And that's, of course, an important issue of public acceptance, as in some European countries, particularly Northwest European countries, there is acceptance of CO2 onshore storage, whereas majority of countries, there is issues with public acceptance of CO2 storage onshore. So effectively, offshore storage is the only realistic possibility so far. In which case, pipelines for CO2 transportation would be required. In terms of regulatory support for the first phase, the strategy suggests the existing rules for closed distribution systems, direct lines, or most importantly, exemptions as they are applied in the gas and electricity markets. So effectively, to get those projects at the initial stage of the ground, the exemptions are envisaged. So not specific framework, but just the exemptions. The strategy says that further retrofitting of existing fossil-based hydrogen production with carbon capture will have to take place during the second phase, which is from 2025 to 2030. At the same time, it says that it is particularly at this stage, that the need for EU-wide logistical infrastructure will appear. It envisages a number of regulatory instruments for the second phase, sort of for branching out into regional and cross-border infrastructure in the EU through such instruments as the 10E regulation, which is currently being revised, and the draft is expected to be finalized by the end of this year. It's also envisaged establishment of common hydrogen quality standards, cross-border operational rules. There is also a review of the alternative fuels infrastructure and the revision of the 10T regulation. And finally, the important point is the review of the internal gas market legislation for competitive decarbonized gas markets. And that's for this year and for the next year. 10E being the main first building block expected later this year.
To jump in there, Alex, and ask you, and it's interesting that what Cash has outlined there, and in terms of the sort of the regulatory changes, I mean, it sounds like a lot of it's based on the existing regulation. Is that an issue you see? I mean, is the EU effectively looking to just adapt its current regulation, or do we see any dramatic changes, you know, to encourage and incentivize what is effectively is a new fuel?
No, I think you're absolutely right. Again, one's kind of reading between the lines here, but the very clear message is that it's use of the existing framework, maybe with a few tweaks, etc., but essentially having liquid traded markets, cross-border infrastructure, regulated third-party access. Now, partly this is driven by the positive aspect that they have this idea that by 2050 there will be a thriving hydrogen market with cross-border transportation, etc. Now, that's good from a hydrogen perspective. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, it means it's definitely on the agenda. The challenge is how we get there. And although the strategy does recognize that infrastructure is going to build up and sort of emerge over time, like this idea of industrial clusters in the early phases, other than what Katja mentioned about using some sort of minimal exemptions, etc., they don't really sort of seem to think that they need to revise the current natural gas framework that much. And the problem I have with that is that the natural gas framework was built for a mature, profitable industry, which already the infrastructure was already in place by the time liberalization happened. And that's clearly not the case for hydrogen. So you have this gap there. And to give you a couple of sort of examples, I can't really see a need for entry exit, daily balancing and capacity and daily capacity auctions when you're trying to get an industrial cluster up and running, which will maybe be one hydrogen producer and two or three very large users and with a very limited network. So I think a lot more thought needs to go into that. But the positive thing is that they see a big role for hydrogen in 2050. The tricky bit is how we get there.
And presumably there's a need to integrate the new regulations around hydrogen with electricity markets as well. It's not just to kind of making the gas thing work. It's integrating with all the other parts of the energy system.
Well, exactly. And they address this by talking about, and this is in the system integration strategy, talking about more coordinated planning between gas networks. And by gas, we're talking about, you know, those that transport hydrogen and electricity networks. But I think actually there's a lot more to it than that. You want to get the pricing signals and the cost incentives right so that when people are deciding, is it better to transport electricity and then use it in electrolysis? Or is it better to do electrolysis near to the source of production and then transport hydrogen? You need to make sure that you get the right cost and pricing signals. You also need to get the right incentives in terms of sector coupling, like whether you should use hydrogen to store renewable electricity, etc. And that can get quite complex, but it's essential if you're to effectively get sort of efficient outcomes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, look, we're coming to the end of our time now. So I'm going to turn to you both for some concluding remarks on what you think of the hydrogen strategy and what are the kind of next steps, if you like. So Katja, let me come to you first. What's your overarching conclusion on the hydrogen strategy and it, positive, negative, and where the big holes are? Give us 30 seconds on that.
The big important and positive thing about the strategy is indeed, as Alex also mentioned, that the EU has a big vision for hydrogen, envisages a big role for hydrogen, very supportive of hydrogen, particularly renewable hydrogen. But what this really needs to have further is sort of a roadmap, how exactly one realizes this vision and how this vision becomes a reality. And that's what we believe in parts is missing somewhat, how exactly you get there. And one of the main points is really how the Commission envisages coordination of development for supply, demand and infrastructure, because clearly the availability of infrastructure for connecting supply and demand is a condition for hydrogen to grow and develop. On the other hand, it's the reverse is also true, which is the availability of sufficient volume of hydrogen is important for networks to develop, to be maintained, to be retrofitted, and to be invested in new networks. So here is clearly very significant need for coordination between these different parts of the value chain. And it's not clear at present, particularly if the Commission envisages that the existing natural gas regulatory framework is a blueprint for hydrogen development. There is an issue problem with, for example, crucially ownership unbundling requirements, which would prevent vertical integration of supply, demand and infrastructure activities. And that's exactly what could potentially hinder development of hydrogen. And that must be addressed through either evolution or revolution.
Okay, great. Alex, same question to you, really. What's your overarching conclusions from this in a minute or so?
Okay, well, first thing, good first step. Good that they recognise the importance of hydrogen. Good that they recognise the need for low-carbon hydrogen as well. Question marks. More thought needed on developing a regulatory framework that enables projects to go ahead in the sort of embryonic stages of the market. And it's good that they recognise that you do need to build a new supply chain. Also, I think everybody needs to recognise the amount of time and effort it will take to do some of the things they want to do, such as revising state aid rules, such as revising the ETS, both of which are fairly complex and controversial subjects. But they've said they want to do this by sort of 2021. And so that's quite an ambitious timetable. So great first step, but lots of more hard work remains to be done.
Jolly good. Okay, well, thank you to you both. It's a very rich sort of topic to delve into, and the insight certainly gives a very good overview of all the issues that are out there. And I know we're going to address them in future research, so we'll look forward to that. The paper itself is available on our website, as is all our research, all our podcasts and webinars. So please go there and find that. But all that remains to me to do now is to say thank you to you all for listening. I hope you found this interesting and informative. Thanks again to Alex and Katya for their intelligent and very explanatory words on the topic. Goodbye and thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts as well as all our written research on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.